Cassette 7, Side 2.
Kathy sat in a lab chair and rocked back, putting her feet up on the console. The skin seemed stretched thin across her cheekbones, dry and papery, lined by sun and fatigue. Jet-lag shadows made crescents under her eyes. Yeah, but those heating up experiments you did first, that's one thing, simple stuff. With people involved, though. You're thinking about paradoxes again, Markham said sympathetically. Having people in the experiment introduces free will, and that leads to the problem of who is the observer in this pseudo-quantum mechanical experiment, and so on. Yeah. And this experiment works. Remember Peterson's bank message. Yeah, but sending this ocean stuff, what would success be like? We wake up one day and that bloom is gone? We're thinking in paradox-making channels again. You're separating yourself from the experiment. The old classical observer, sort of. See, things don't have to be casual. They only have to be self-consistent. She sighed. I don't know what the new field equations say about that. Here's a copy of my paper on the coupled solutions. Maybe you... Combining quantum mechanical supersymmetry and general relativity with tachyons in? Yeah. Hey, that's worth looking at. Markham brightened. A lot of the old features are still in these equations, I can tell you that much. Every quantum mechanical event, that is, involving tachyons in the paradox-producing loop, still leads to a kind of scattering into a family of event probabilities. A wave pattern between past and future. A light switch hung up between on and off? Yes. So we still get probabilistic predictions. No certainties. I think so. Or at least the formalism has that part in it. But there's something else. I haven't had time to figure it out. If there were time to think. Markham puzzled over the neatly typed pages of equations. Interpreting this is the hard part. The mathematics is so new. Yeah, I sure as hell wish that guy Peterson hadn't yanked me away from Caltech. Thorne and I were on the verge. Her head jerked up. Say, how did Peterson know about me? You tell him? No, I didn't know you were working on this. Her eyes narrowed. Then she shrugged. He's got some power, that much I can tell. Seems like a typical English prig. Markham looked uncomfortable. Well, I don't know. Okay. Put that down to my jet lag. Flight was packed, too. Jesus. I wish Peterson had held off for a week or so. Markham saw Peterson emerge from where Renfrew was working and signaled to Kathy. She put on a bland, faintly comical face. Markham hoped Peterson wouldn't notice. Just talk to my staff, Peterson said, hitching thumbs into his waistcoat as he approached. I had them look into the people who were working at NMR at Columbia, Moscow, and La Jolla around 1963. Biographies and so on. Markham said, Yes, that's an obvious thing to check, isn't it? Trust Ian to cut through all this physics and try something simple. Peterson glanced at Markham, eyebrow lifting microscopically. Staff haven't much time with all that's going on. They turned up nothing obvious, like papers in the scientific journals. There was something about spontaneous resonance that never reappeared. Seems to have been a red herring. But nothing about tachyons or messages. One chap did stumble on a piece in New Scientist about messages from space, though, and credited an NMR chap named Bernstein. There's a reference to some television appearance, along with a Life in the Universe type. Can your staff dig that out? Kathy asked. Perhaps. A lot was lost with the Central Park nuke, I'm told. The network files were in Manhattan. News programs 35 years old aren't kept in multiple copies either. I've put a woman to searching, but Sir Martin's got a crash program going on this... He broke off suddenly. You think it was this Bernstein who left that note in the bank? Markham asked. Possibly. But if that is all the effect Renfrew's beams have had, the ocean information hasn't got through. Markham shook his head. Wrong tense. We can still keep transmitting. If one message made it, others can. Free will again, Kathy said. Or free won't, Peterson said mildly. Look here, I've got to go into Cambridge, see to a few matters. Could you give me a briefing on your work, Kathy, before I go? She nodded. Markham said, Renfrew's having a little party tonight. He means to invite you, I know. Well, Peterson looked at Kathy. I'll try to come round. Don't absolutely have to be back in London until tomorrow. He and Kathy Wickham went into Renfrew's small office to use the blackboard. Markham watched them talking through the clear glass panelling of the door. Peterson seemed caught up in the physics of the tachyons and had largely forgotten the supposed usefulness of them. The two figures moved back and forth before the board, Kathy making diagrams and symbols with quick swoops of the chalk. Peterson studied them, frowning. He seemed to be watching her more than the board. Chapter 24. Markham gestured with the hand that held his drink, spilling a little on the Renfrew's grey carpet. Absent-mindedly, he dabbed at it with his foot, as if uncertain whether it was due to him, and went on talking to Kathy Wickham. Those new equations of yours have some funny solutions. There's the old probability wave for the casual loops, yes, but... He kept on in a dreamy, thoughtful way, at the same time in the back of his mind, hoping Jan would arrive soon. He had called her from the lab when Renfrew told him that this gathering was to be a sort of informal bon voyage party for him. Renfrew was pinning hopes on overcoming the noise problem on the Brookhaven equipment, and Markham's dexterity at talking them out of it. Pissing down out, isn't it? Renfrew remarked, peering out a window. It was. A brooding gloom had followed the sudden thundering rain. Peterson, driving in from Cambridge, had had to roll his window down and lean out to see the gate. Markham walked to the window and caught the heavy scent of damp earth and sodden leaves. Winged sycamore seeds spiraled down into the wet hedgerows. A soaked world. Marjorie Renfrew hovered at the edge of the Peterson-Wickham-Markham triangle, unable to join in the casual science chat. John Renfrew prowled the room, pushing little plates of finger food a centimetre nearer the true centre of the little tables. His face was flushed, and he seemed to have drunk quite a lot already. The doorbell rang. None of them had heard an approaching car in the hammering rain. Marjorie dashed to answer, looking relieved. Markham heard her voice in the hall, running on with no pause for an answer. What a terrible evening. Isn't it absolutely awful? Come in. Haven't you got a raincoat? Oh, you must live here, no matter what. I'm glad Greg reached you. It was at the last minute, yes, but I'm quite surrounded by scientists here and need someone to talk to. He saw rain dripping steadily from the edges of the porch roof behind Jan, before Marjorie closed the door, bucking it with her shoulder to get it into the jam. Hi, hon. He kissed her with a casual warmth. Let's get you dry. He ignored Marjorie's fluttering and tugged Jan into the living room. A real wood fire. How lovely, Jan said. I thought it would cheer things up, Marjorie confided. But actually, in a way, it's depressing. It makes it seem like autumn, and it's still only August, for goodness sake. The weather seems to have gone haywire. Do you know everyone? Greg asked. Let's see, this is Kathy Wickham. Kathy, now sitting on the sofa with John Renfrew, nodded to her. Oh, to be in California, now that August's here, eh? And this is Ian Peterson. Ian, my wife, Jan. Peterson shook hands with her. Well, how did the experiment go? Jan asked the company at large. Oh, heavens, don't start them on that, Marjorie said quickly. I was hoping we could talk about something else now you're here.
Both good and bad, Greg said, ignoring Marjorie. We got a lot of noise, but Cather's detailed explanation of the noise level and spectrum sounds good. So, with better electronics, John here can sidestep some of the problem.
I'm surprised Peterson can't get it for you with a telephone lift of his finger, Kathy said sharply. Heads turned towards her. She wagged her jaw back and forth, the sidewise swaying intense and unconscious. My omnipotence is overrated, Peterson said mildly. It's impressive to see the scientific tail wagging the CIA dock. I'm sure I don't know what you mean. People ought to put files back the way they found them. I'm sure I have no idea what you're... Are you going to hide behind that memorized sentence forever? Marjorie stared at the two in horror, caught by the spark of tension. Won't you have something to drink, Jan? She broke in desperately, her voice a little too loud. Peterson's brittle retort drowned Jan's quiet reply. Here in England, we still rather think discretion and civility oil the wheels of social intercourse, Miss Wickham. Dr. Wickham, if we're going to be formal, Mr. Peterson. Dr. Wickham, of course. He made the word an insult. Kathy straightened, her shoulders rigid with fury. Your sort can't bear to see a woman as anything but a mindless lay, can you? I assure you that that is not the case in relation to yourself, Peterson said sulkily. He turned to Renfrew, who looked as though he wished himself 1,000 miles away. Markham sipped his drink, looking from one to the other with alert interest. Better than the usual party small talk. Funny. That wasn't the impression I got this afternoon, Kathy continued doggedly. But then you haven't learned to take rejection very well, have you? Peterson's hand clenched on the stem of his glass, knuckles bleached white. He turned slowly. Marjorie said feebly, Oh my goodness. You must have misunderstood something I said, Dr. Wickham, he said at last. I would hardly raise the subject with a woman of your persuasion. For a moment, no one else moved or spoke. Then John Renfrew walked to the fireplace and stood in front of it, legs planted firmly apart, holding his mug of beer. He frowned, looking every inch the solid English squire. Look, he said, this is my house, and I expect my guests to behave civilly to each other in it. You're quite right, Renfrew, Peterson replied promptly. I apologize. Put it down to intolerable provocation. It had the effect of making Kathy seem ungracious. Oh, God, she said ruefully. John, I'm sorry I had to get carried away in your house, but I did enjoy being rude to him. That's it, Renfrew declared. No more. He waved his mug in dismissal. Well done, John, Jan said. Stand on your rights. Now, if I might have that drink? She moved towards him, smiling. The rigid circle broke, tension dissipating. He took her elbow and they crossed to the sideboard. Peterson went to talk to Marjorie. Greg sat down on the sofa next to Kathy Wickham. Well, I think I took a fall in that round, she said cheerfully. But it was worth it for a minute or two there. Did he actually proposition you? Greg asked. I was right there and never noticed a thing. Jan joined them, perched on the edge of the sofa. You're kidding, Kathy laughed. Of course he did. Familiarity breeds a tempt or something, but to come right out and... Oh, he was very subtle and discreet about it. Left room for a gracious refusal, save his ego and all. Self-satisfied bastard. But Jan disapproves of my actions. Don't you, Jan? Well, yes. I think you made things too uncomfortable for John and Marjorie. Frankly, I have the same opinion of him that you do. But this is fascinating, Greg said. Let's hear you two get your claws into the poor guy. Poor guy? He's a highly successful, confident, slimy toad who despises women. You're going to take his side as a man against 2 catty females? He despises women? Greg asked, startled. I would have thought the opposite was true. Jan and Kathy exchanged glances. He loathes us, every one. He can't stand rejection by an inferior being. Why do you think he implied I was gay? Are you? She shrugged. I'm bi, actually. But yeah, I tend to prefer women. Don't look now, but old Ian is putting the make on our dear hostess. She's blushing like crazy. Markham twisted in his seat and stared across the room, curious. Christ, I can't imagine that. She doesn't strike me as sexy at all. Besides, she'd probably talk all the time. Now who's being catty? At least she's obviously heterosexual. That's all Peterson needs to soothe his wounded ego. It'll be Jan's turn next. Jan raised an eyebrow. Oh, come now. With Greg right here in the room? Anyway, he must know that I don't particularly care for him. You think either of those facts would bother him? Go talk to him. I bet it won't take 5 minutes before he makes a pass at you. Then you can cut him down to size. Jan shook her head. I'd rather avoid the experience. God, that's too much, Greg said. I can't believe he's that bad. Kathy made a face at him. Well, bugger you. I'm going to talk to John about his experiment. She got up and left them.
Well? Greg asked.
Well, what?
Don't you think she's overdoing it on Peterson? You think he really made a pass at her?
I'm quite sure he did. But I think what bothers her is being pulled away from her own work by someone who won't treat her like a scientist. And it can be pleasant knowing one's personal papers have been gone through.
Oh, the hell with it. Peterson seems quite reasonable to me compared to the rest of the company. Renfrew's dull outside of the lab. Marjorie's a nit. And Kathy's abrasive. Jesus, is only thee and me that's normal.
And even thee's a bit queer, she supplied wryly. I thought you were feeling good about the experiment. Why is everyone in such a terrible mood?
You're right, we're all edgy, aren't we? It's not the experiment. Personally, I'm not looking forward to flying to Washington.
You what?
Oh, God, of course, I haven't had a chance to tell you yet. Here, let me get you another drink and I'll explain.
But we're planning... I know, but this will only take a few days and...
The other guests studiously avoided the sofa while Jan and Greg settled their family logistics. Then the Markhams sat for a while, listening to the flow of English conversation around them, the long A's and rising inflections. Kathy had wandered out to the patio, announcing that the rain had passed, unnoticed in the tension of the living room. A stretched, artificial good humour seemed to tighten the throats of Peterson and Renfrew as they talked. Their words became clipped and slightly higher in tone. Marjorie's rushed sentences wove between theirs in a kind of bird-like counterpoint. Peterson was describing the immense paperwork boondoggle surrounding the saving of the Sumatran and Javan species of rhinoceros. The World Council had decided to redirect money for the Javan dieback into isolating the rhino. Eco-inventory had dictated that as part of the stabilization plan aimed at saving species. The one species in excess was, of course, humans. The Council's policies had been applauded by the environmental types, politely not mentioning that in the zero-sum game of resources, this meant less available land and money for people.
Matter of choices, Peterson said distantly, swirling the amber fluid in his glass.
Wise nods.
Greg Markham said to Marjorie Renfrew,
No, forget that scene between Kathy and Ian. Means nothing. We're all edgy lately.
They were standing on the patio at the edge of the orange glow from inside.
But scientists are less emotional, I thought, and to have them at each other.
First, Peterson's not a scientist. Second, all that about suppressing emotion is mostly a convenient legend. When Newton and Hooke were having their famous dispute over who discovered the inverse square law, I'm sure they were livid with rage. But it took 2 weeks to get a letter, back and forth. Newton had time to consider his reply. Kept the discussion on a high plane, you see. These days, if a scientist writes a letter, he publishes the damn thing. The interaction time is very low and the tempers flare higher.
Still, you don't think that explains the irritability of the times? Marjorie observed shrewdly.
No, there's something more. A feeling.
Greg shook his head.
Ah, rat's ass. I should stick to physics. Even there, of course, we don't really know much that's basic.
Really? Why?
Well, take the bare fact that all electrons have the same mass and charge. So do their antiparticles, the positrons. Why? Well, you can talk about fields and vacuum fluctuations and so on, but I like the old Wheeler idea. They have the same mass because they're all the same particle.
Marjorie smiled. How can that be?
There's only one electron in the universe, see?
An electron traveling backwards in time looks like it's an antiparticle, a positron. So you bounce one electron back and forth through time. Make everything out of that one particle. Dogs and dinosaurs, stones and stars.
But why would it travel back in time?
Tachyon collision? I don't know.
Greg's levity evaporated.
My point is, the foundation of everything is shaky. Even logic itself has holes in it. Theories are based on pictures of the world, human pictures.
He looked upward, and Marjorie's eyes followed. Constellations hung like blazing chandeliers. A distant airplane droned. A green light winked at its tail.
I rather like the old Saturn things, she began shyly.
So we can have our cake and eat it too? Greg asked impishly.
Nonsense.
We have to go on. Let's get back inside.
Markham went to the window and gazed up at the clearing skies.
Makes you wonder what sort of clouds drop this water, doesn't it? He mused half to himself.
His head turned, looking idly around the yard, and suddenly stopped.
Say, who are they?
John Renfrew came over to the window and peered out into the gloom.
Who? I say, they're into our garage.
Markham turned from the window, thinking of the man at the bus stop the other day.
What have you got in there?
Renfrew hesitated, studying the shadowy figures, who now had the garage door swung open.
Tools. Old things that...
Food, Marjorie exclaimed. My preserves are stored there, and tin things.
That's what they're after, Markham said decisively. The squatters down the way, Renfrew muttered to himself.
Call the police, Marjorie.
Oh, my, she said, unmoving.
Go on!
John gave her a push.
I'll do it,
Jan said briskly. She ran into the hall.
Let's head him off, Markham said.
He picked up a poker from the hearth, almost casually.
No,
John said.
The police will. These guys will be long gone by that time, Markham said.
He strode quickly to the front door and opened it.
Let's go.
They may be armed,
Peterson's voice called after him. Markham sprinted out the door and onto the lawn. Renfrew followed.
Aye,
a voice from the garage cried.
Scarber!
Come on,
Markham called. He ran towards the dark moor of the open garage. He could make out a man stooped over picking up a carton. Two others were carrying things. They hesitated as Markham came down on them. He raised the poker and called out towards the house.
Hey, John, got your gun?
The men unfroze. Two bolted down the drive. Greg charged forward and got between them and the gate. He swung the poker. It made a loud swoosh. The men stopped. They backed away, looking at the hedges to each side of the yard. Renfrew ran at the third man. The dark figure sidestepped and slipped past him. At that moment, Kathy Wickham came down the steps of the porch. Renfrew slipped on the wet grass.
Christ!
The man picked up speed, looking back at Renfrew. Kathy Wickham, trying to make out the shadows on the lawn, stopped dead in the path. The figure smashed into her. They sprawled on the stones. Markham swung the poker back and forth in front of him. The men seemed paralyzed by the sound of it. In the gloom, they couldn't tell how close it came. Markham could not judge the distance either. Ignorant armies clash by night, he thought giddily. Should he charge them?
Your friend's bought his,
he called out clearly. They both turned to look. The yellow rectangle of the door sent a blade of light out onto the glistening lawn. In the beam, John Renfrew yanked the fallen man to his feet and said,
What's your...
Markham stepped quietly forward and swung the poker, crack, into the nearest man's leg.
Ah!
The struck man collapsed. His partner saw Markham rearing up out of the shadows and backed away. Suddenly he turned and ran diagonally across the lawn. Markham tried to keep both men in sight. Two down, one to go.
Look out, Greg. He's got a knife,
Kathy Wickham shouted. The man turned, transfixed by the yellow light in the center of the lawn. Metal glinted in his hand.
Now you just leave off, he said roughly.
Markham walked towards him. Swoosh, swoosh. The sound caught the man's attention. He and Peterson came trotting forward.
Let him go,
he called to Markham.
Hell no,
Markham answered with gusto.
No point in risking. We've got him,
Markham insisted. That one's getting away, Kathy Wickham cried. The man lying in the drive had moved at a crouch towards the gate. As she spoke, he ran with a limp to the gate and vaulted over it.
Damn,
Markham said with chagrin.
Should have covered him.
No need for melodramatics, Peterson called mildly. The police will be here shortly.
Markham glanced back at Renfrew.
Eric!
The man with the knife shouted.
Switch!
Abruptly, before Markham could understand the signal, the two men moved. Renfrew's captive wrenched away from him and dashed back towards the garage. Markham followed. The man ran into the dark of the garage. Markham hesitated. He could see nothing. Suddenly, the man reappeared, a shadow. Markham could make out that he had something long in his hand. Markham backed away warily. He saw the man with the knife moving towards the gate, an elementary maneuver to distract him. The shadow stepped further into the light and swung a rake at Markham's head. Markham ducked and jumped backwards.
Christ, somebody...
Both men suddenly ran for the gate. One turned and threw the rake directly at Markham. He dodged aside.
Bastards!
He shouted and hurled the poker after them into the darkness. He listened to their footsteps fade away.
No use going after them,
Renfrew said at his side. Kathy Wickham agreed.
Leave them to the police, Greg.
Yeah, okay,
he mumbled. They trailed back into the house.
There was a moment of silence, and then everyone began chattering about the incident. Markham noted that those who had stayed inside and watched from the door had a different view of the details. They thought Renfrew had subdued his man, when in fact the fellow had simply been waiting for a proper opening for escape. The relativity of experience, Markham thought. He was still puffing from the exertion, adrenaline singing in him. From the distance came the two-tone hooting of a siren.
The police, Peterson said swiftly. Late as usual. Look, I'm going to cut and run before they get here. I don't want to have to answer questions for the rest of the night. You fellows are the heroes, anyway. Thanks for the drinks, and goodbye, everyone.
He left hastily. Markham watched him go. He reflected on the fact that their first unthinking response had been to assume the shadowy figures were thieves. There was no hesitation, no one suggesting it was some mistake, people who'd got the wrong house. 20 years ago, that might have been the case. Now? The others, standing in the centre of the living room, drank a toast to each other. The siren drew nearer.
Chapter 25, July 1963. Gordon saw that he would have to spend a lot of the summer working with Cooper. The candidacy exam had been a blow. Cooper took weeks to recover his self-confidence. Gordon finally had to sit him down and give him a Dutch uncle talk. They decided on a routine. Cooper would study fundamentals each morning to prepare for a second try at the exam. Afternoons and evenings, he would take data. By autumn, he would have enough to analyze in detail. By that time, with coaching from Gordon, Cooper could take the exam again with some confidence. With luck, winter would find him with most of his thesis data complete. Cooper listened, nodded, said little. At times, he seemed moody. His new data came out smooth, unblemished. No signals. Gordon felt a letdown whenever he looked over Cooper's lab books and saw the bland, ordinary curves. Could the effect come and go like that? Why? How? Or was Cooper simply discarding all the resonances which didn't fit his thesis? If you were damned certain you weren't looking for something, there was a very good chance you wouldn't see it. But Cooper kept everything in his notebooks, as a good experimenter should. The books were messy, but they were always complete. Gordon thumbed through them daily, looking for unexplained blank spots or scratched-out entries. Nothing seemed wrong. Still, he remembered the physicists in the 1930s who had bombarded substances with neutrons. They had carefully rigged their Geiger counters so that once the neutron barrage stopped, the counters shut off too, to avoid some sources of experimental error. If they had left the counters on, they would have discovered that some substances emitted high-energy particles for a long time afterward, artificially induced radioactivity. By being careful, they missed the unexpected and lost a Nobel Prize. The July issue of Physics Today carried a piece in the Search and Discovery section dealing with spontaneous resonance. There was a sample of the data taken from the Physical Review Letters paper. Lakin was quoted extensively. The effect, he said, promises to show us a new kind of interaction which can occur in type 3 to 5 compounds, such as indium antimonide, and perhaps in all compounds, if the experiments are sensitive enough to pick up this effect. There was no mention of the apparent correlations between the times when the spontaneous resonances appeared. Gordon decided to attack the spontaneous resonance phenomenon afresh. The message idea made sense to him. At least something was there. But the rebuffs from his colleagues could not be ignored. Okay, maybe they were right. Maybe a series of bizarre coincidences led him to believe there were coded words in the scope traces. In that case, what was the explanation? Lakin was afraid the concentration on the message idea would obscure the true problem. Okay, say Lakin was right. Say they were all right. What other explanation was possible? He worked for several weeks on alternatives. The theory governing Cooper's original experiment was not particularly deep. Gordon labored through it, pondering the assumptions, redoing the integrals, checking each step. Some fresh ideas cropped up. He studied each one in turn, running it to ground with equations and order of magnitude estimates. The earlier theory dropped some mathematical terms. He investigated them, looking for ways they could suddenly stop being negligible and upset the theory. Nothing seemed to fit his needs. He reread the original papers, hoping for an offhand clue. Pick, Coringa, Overhauser, Fair, Clark. The papers were classics, unassailable. There were no visible escape hatches from the canonical theory. He was pursuing a calculation at his desk, waiting for Cooper to show up for a conference, when his telephone rang. "Dr. Bernstein?" the voice of the department secretary asked. He said, distracted. "Professor Tallaire would like to see you." "Oh, okay." Tallaire was chairman. "When, Joyce?" "Now, if it's convenient." When Joyce ushered him into the long, spare room, the chairman was reading what Gordon recognized as a personnel folder. Events soon confirmed that it was his. "Briefly," Tallaire said, "I have to tell you that your merit increase has been, subject to controversy." "I thought it was a standard thing. I mean, ordinarily, it is. The department meets only to consider promotions from assistant professor to associate professor, that is, getting tenure, or from associate professor to full professor." "Uh-huh." "A merit increase, as in your case, from assistant professor step 2 to assistant professor step 3, does not require the entire department vote. We usually ask the senior men in the candidates group, in your case, the spin, resonance, and solid state group, to give an opinion. I am afraid..." "Lakin vetoed it, huh?" Tallaire looked up in alarm. "Now, I did not say that." "But you meant it." "I will not discuss individual comments." Tallaire looked worried for a moment and then sat back, studying the tip of his pencil as though a solution lay there. "However, you realize the events of the last few months have not inspired a great deal of confidence in your fellow faculty members." "So I had guessed." Tallaire began a series of reflections on scientific credibility, keeping the discussion safely vague. Gordon listened, hoping there would be something in it he could learn from. Tallaire was not the standard administrator's sort, in love with his own voice, and this little lecture was more a defense mechanism than an oration. Despite his earlier bravado, Gordon began to feel a sinking sensation steal into his legs. This was serious. The merit increase was routine, Only really questionable cases had trouble. The big test was the leap from assistant professor to associate professor, which spelled tenure. Gordon had started out as assistant professor 1 and had been advanced to 2 within a year, which was speedy. Most faculty spent 2 years at each step. Once he reached assistant 3, he could be promoted to associate 1, although the typical route was to go to assistant 4 before making the jump to tenure. But now, he wasn't going to make the standard step from 2 to 3 on schedule. That didn't bode well for his prospects when he came up for tenure review. A coldness had reached up from his legs into his chest when Tulare said, "Of course you have to be careful of what you do in any field, Gordon," and discussed the necessary wariness a scientist had to have, the quality of being skeptical about his own findings. Then, incredibly, Tulare launched into a recital of the story of Einstein and the notebook for writing down thoughts, ending in the line, "So Einstein said, 'I doubt it. I have only had 2 or 3 good ideas in my life.'" Tulare slapped the desk with genuine mirth, relieved at being able to turn a difficult interview into something lighter. "So, you see, Gordon, not every idea is a good one." Gordon made a weak smile. He had told that story to Boyle and the Carraways, and they had sat there and laughed. Undoubtedly, they had heard it before. They were simply humoring a junior faculty member who must have appeared to be a buffoon. He stood up. His legs were strangely weak. He found that he was breathing quickly, but there was no discernible cause. Gordon murmured something to Tulare and turned away. He knew he should be most concerned about the merit increase, but for the moment all he could think of was the Carraways and their smiles and his own vast stupidity. Chapter 26, July 7th, 1963. During the summer, the rhythm of their days changed. Penny began to sleep later, and Gordon found himself waking before her. He resolved that he would stick to his Canadian Air Force exercise program religiously, and the best time to do it was in the early hours on the deserted stretches of Windon Sea Beach. He never liked doing them at home, particularly if Penny was there. He liked going down to the white sands, which had been cleaned by the night tides, and working his way through the exercises as the sunlight brimmed above Mount Soledad to the east. Then he would run as far as possible along the beach. Each cove was a scooped-out world of its own, the shadows shortening as the sun rose. His sheen of sweat cooled in the blue shadows, and the thick ocean air had a tangible watery weight as he sucked it in, puffing, legs setting a thump, thump, thump that came up through the bones, a curious sound in this air, like chunks of wood falling on an oak floor. He had run like this when he was a kid, on the scruffy beaches of New Jersey. His Uncle Herb took him there often, just after his father started with the sickness. When Jersey crowded in summertime, Uncle Herb took him for rides in a yellow Studebaker out to Long Island. His mother had always spoken of the people who lived out there, of people who actually owned beachfront property, as though they were another race. The first time Uncle Herb took him, Gordon asked if they were going to visit relatives, hoping he had some thread of connection with those mythical folk. Uncle Herb laughed in his quick, barking, not altogether friendly way, and wheezed, "Yeah, I'm going to visit a Mr. Gatsby, don't you know?" and slapped the side of the big yellow car, making a solid metallic thump. Gordon had sat with his arm out the window for the whole trip, the summer breeze of their passage caressing the black hair on his arm. The hair was more apparent that summer. Gordon compared his to Uncle Herb's and found that he had made remarkable progress in just a year. It took 6 more years before he understood the enigmatic remark about Gatsby. By the time he had read the book, ignoring the proffered Malamud from his mother, he could no longer remember much about the big houses on Long Island, or whether any of them had a green light on the end of a dock, or any of the other stuff. The beaches there, he remembered, were thin and stony, a bleak margin begrudged by the big inland estates. There wasn't much to do. Children built sandcastles, which their parents periodically approved, peering into the yellow-blue sun haze over the tops of their paperback books. He remembered thinking that if Long Island was typical, Goyish life was dull. By contrast, Uncle Herb took him to some actual prize fights that summer, fights as big and real as he'd ever thought life could be. Thump, thump, his legs pounded on, and before him, he saw again the white square of the ring, the two figures dancing and punching, a head jerking back when hit, the ref waltzing around the men, shouts and whistles, and a hot, close, salty smell from the liquid crowd. "Did you see that guy Alberts in the fifth round?" Uncle Herb said at the intermission. "Feet like sandbags? Like a guy looking for a collar button he dropped. Yeesh." And after the decision, "Those refs. Giving him two rounds. Using what for eyes? I wouldn't want to go on hunting trips with them." Thump, 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 and the salty smell of the crowd went away, and Gordon was running into a rising sun. The tang in his nostrils was a sea breeze thousands of miles from Long Island, and he was throwing fists out as he ran, uppercuts and cross punches and jabs with their own rhythm, his feet connected to his fists, panting hard, a face muddy and formless in front of him, now resolving into Lakin, as Gordon wondered at it at the same instant that he gave it two of his best, a fake and a belly punch, and then the jab, fast and easy, and then some more as he thought about Lakin, and began to self-consciously erase the swimming face, but held it for three quick jabs, his knuckles sailing through the milky image, and the head rocking back. One, two, three times. Thump, thump, thump. Yeah. Uncle Herb taking him places that whole summer long, while his father was hanging on, keeping the boy's mind occupied. Gordon threw two more punches at the air, aiming at he didn't know what. Mind filled with yeah, with fights, and beaches, and books, while his father said nothing. Smiled when you talked to him. Never complained. Just crawled away from everyone to die. The way they did it in the Bernstein family. Just quietly. No fuss. Nobody beating the drum for you. Not for a Bernstein. Thump, thump, thump. The beach sand now warming under his feet. Sweat trickling into his eyes. Stinging. Blurring the morning. His throat raw. Jesus, he had run a long way. The cliffs were high here. He had slogged past Scripps Pier and down to Black's Beach, a long deserted stretch below the Torrey Pines Park. He was running in shadow now, and as he brushed the sweat from his eyes, he suddenly saw that he was about to stumble on something. He leaped, thinking it was a sleeping dog, ran on by reflex, and looked back. A couple, legs akimbo, woman's heels pointed at the sky, the whites of four eyes. Jesus, he thought, but somehow it didn't disturb him that much. The idea was logical. Lonely beach, horny couple, beautiful sunrise, salty smell. But it did mean he had to run even farther, give them time to finish their thump, thump, thump. Certainly it was a better vision to end the run with than Lakin's creamy face, Gordon thought muzzily. Lakin was a problem he couldn't solve, and maybe, he saw, that was why he was running so far, wearing himself out so a real fist wouldn't smack into a real face. Maybe, yeah, and maybe not. He had Uncle Herb's contempt for too much analysis. One way to be a potzer was to worry about things like that too much, yeah. Gordon smiled and licked his lips and threw two more punches, slicing the forgiving air.
This ends side 2 of cassette 7 of Timescape. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 8.